Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how the companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Biraj Rai is the CEO of Brahmin International, a global language services and market expansion firm he co-founded in 2000. The business has grown from a localization specialist into a strategic international growth partner for enterprise brands across fintech, e-commerce, SaaS and e-learning. Under his leadership, Brahmin has built a remarkable track record, serving over 250 clients worldwide, operating across 100 plus languages and maintaining a near perfect customer retention rate since inception. The company has been recognized with the SAP Service Recognition Award for ERP localization and was a pioneer in deploying world-class language technology platforms with seamless automation for its clients. With over two decades of experience in global business strategy, Biraj specializes in cross-border growth, multilingual content, cultural intelligence, and digital readiness. Biraj, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Aidan, for having me here. Absolute pleasure.
Great.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Now, because the business is unusual, right, I think probably the best place to start is to tell us what you do and where it all began.
Yeah, it's an interesting journey. And we started in 2000, as you mentioned. And it literally, as an idea, started over a cup of tea. Here we would say coffee, but yeah. In India we say coffee. So it started in India, actually. And we were a group of, my eldest brother was there, who's also a shareholder of this company. And we had some other colleagues from our past. And if you remember what happened in 2000, do you remember 2000?
Oh, I do.
And Bangalore back then was, and it still is, the Silicon Valley of India. And every second day we would hear 100, 150, 200 companies shutting shop. And, you know, I used to work for a company that used to develop e-learning curriculum, and my brother used to work with another large software company, and my eldest brother used to be into some other strategic consulting services. And we all got together and we said, we can do probably better. And we think that, you know, companies are shutting shop because their fundamentals are not strong enough. And we think we won't make those mistakes. When you start off, you actually don't know what you're getting into, honestly. And I was only 24 years old, barely with less than a year's experience in the corporate world. So, you know, there's an advantage to that at that age, the risk is very low. And, I had a bit of a backing from the family, and, you know, there was, being youngest in the family, it was, you know, not much responsibility at home, you can call it that way. And so the entry point for me was really not that risky. The only thing probably was that we knew nothing what we wanted to do. So initially when we started, we wanted to do everything, right? We would say we can do software, we can do websites, we can do e-learning, we can do everything except languages.
Okay.
Back in those days, we didn't know what language business was, what localization was, what translation was. We didn't even think that was actually business. And I used to work for a company that used to develop online curriculum. And back in those days, there were CD-ROMs. So we used to call them CBTs, computer-based training. And it was a fairly large US-based company, so I had a good experience working with them. And so I thought that why not actually start with that as one of the core business areas. And to be fortunate enough, in the first year we did get a couple of projects which were into, e-learning. But even in our very first project, you know, the customer said, look, you know, we actually want our presentations and, the content in other languages because we have got global employees. And we had no clue how to do it. So we outsourced it to one of the companies through one of the references. And they did actually the work for the other languages, whether it was Thai, Vietnamese or whatever. And we were very happy because ultimately the customer liked the work and said, okay, great. And this is how we were like catching on to any project, whether it was website development, whether it was e-learning, whether it was, you know, we didn't do a lot of software, but we did websites, we did training content, multimedia content, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And in about 3 years' time, we had enough experience and exposure to know a lot about this e-learning, multimedia, and, you know, we had several clients back then, but mostly Indian.
Right.
And what happened was that in 2003, we thought, you know, we are actually doing some part of our business in different languages, but not consciously. You know, it was only because the customers were telling us,
we need this.
We need this. Yeah. Why only in English? Because we have employees or we have customers or some kind of a sales interface which they had to reach out. And so in 2003, during our internal meetings, we thought, why not actually check what this industry looks like? And we had a guy in our sales who did a lot of the work in digging out. And he said, look, actually translation and localization is a dedicated industry. And this is the size of the industry. This is how it's supposed to grow. These are the associations and stuff like that. He said, okay, why don't you actually talk to some of these potential language services companies? So we call them LSPs. Why don't you actually talk to some of these global large size language service companies who could probably be looking at partners in different countries, because language is not easy business. Mm. And when it comes to putting the language component in a product or a service, it's not just translation. It starts telling you about the culture and everything else, how people use the product, their behaviors and stuff like that. And I'm sure if there is a very large American or a European language service provider and they need to enter into, let's say, the Indian market or the Southeast Asian market, they don't know these markets very well. And we were right. When we approached a lot of these global language service providers, they wanted partners in India in the what we call as Indic languages. Mm-hmm. So Indic is really the Indian subcontinent, not just the Indian languages, but all the places around it, mm-hmm. Sri Lanka, Bhutan, Pakistan, you know, Nepal, Bangladesh, stuff like that. And my very first visit and customer was actually in Ireland.
Okay.
So there was a company called Bourne Global Solutions, or Bowen, they used to call it, Bowen Global Solutions. And later on, it got over by another company. But they were actually one of those pioneers who actually taught us formally what language services business was actually. They had great people, and they kept us walking us through different technical requirements, different skills of what it requires to actually get a product or a service ready for that market. Mm-hmm. And that was the starting point of our getting into the language industry. They were one of our first customers. And they gave us work initially in multimedia e-learning content for kids, which had to be done in Hindi. But once that happened, we had gone over that bridge to understand what potential the language business had. So it was quite by accident we got into the language business from the learning and training industry. But once we got there, I think it was just a question of time, because we had identified the language service provider market. And a lot of the LSPs were really struggling with the Asian, Southeast Asian, Indian languages. So they were actually looking for somebody to help them. And so when we start speaking to them, I think from 2003 to 2007, we had acquired 5 or 6 customers, and 3 of them were actually in Ireland.
Okay.
And that's where the Irish journey actually started.
Well, I was going to ask. Yeah. It's all great, but how did you end up in Ireland?
So Bond Global used to have their headquarters in Dunleary. Mm-hmm. And I still remember my very first visit to Ireland was in 15 days just before I got married in 2004, in November 2004. I had a few meetings in the UK, and I had 2 meetings in Dublin. And one was this company, and one was another company called Transware. And Transware also was one of those pioneer companies, not very large, later on again got acquired by another company. And so with these 2 meetings, I had acquired both the clients in Ireland on just that first visit. And also, I was just there for that one night and I was flying out. But just in the 24 hours that I spent in Ireland, I just fell in love with this place, with the people. I had such a great experience in those just for 24 to maybe 30 hours of how I could talk to people anywhere on the street. You know, 2004 was actually very different from what it is now in Dublin. You could literally shout across the road then, catch people's attention, talk to them for hours. You get into a public transport, you could talk to anybody. A lot of it is still the same, but, you know, of course, things change. But I just fell in love with the place and I said, okay, I've got two clients here. I've just got to keep coming back here. So that's where the Irish journey started.
Okay.
Later on, of course, it got cemented. With, like I said, by 2007, we had five customers and three of them were from Ireland. And by 2011, we had five customers. And my journey to Ireland kept becoming more frequent. And sometime, I think maybe in 2008, when the crash happened, you know, back then a lot of the meetings that I had, and I had a few meetings with the IDA. And IDA encouraged me to say, why don't you actually start looking for an office here? Why don't you have your European headquarters here? And we seriously started considering to have our first international office. So the debate we were having internally was, why not London? Of course, Dublin, we had a couple of customers in the UK as well. And they were also large-sized companies. And then, you know, there were suggestions for some people also about Germany. So we were thinking about these three places. But ultimately what happened was we did actually, the first decision we did take was for the UK, incidentally. So we set up shop there, I think in 2010-11, in an incubation center. But, you know, 1 year of operations in the UK told me several things when I was comparing, you know, things in Ireland and UK. One, of course, back then we were investing from India. And, you know, when you convert Indian rupees into pounds, it's a totally different story as compared to converting it into euros. It becomes a whole lot more expensive. And even though UK as a country has great ties with India, with, you know, all kinds of networks and, you know, and it's a bigger market as well. So there were compelling reasons for us to continue there. But, you know, sometimes you have this hunch. So I don't have a scientific answer to say why I came up in Dublin, except the fact that, like I said, I lost my heart to this place. But when we actually did open up the incubation center in London, we did not acquire any business that year in the UK. And it was a lot of struggle in talking to customers, getting through to them. Whereas we already had five customers in Dublin. And so, and IDA all this along was very persistent. And, you know, the climate in Ireland was very different. You know, it was, you know, everybody was available to work. There were cheaper properties available. You name it.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those things. So we did actually close down the UK office and set up an incubation in probably, you know, the digital depot, the digital hub in the Liberties. And they used to have an incubation, and they used to give a 50% discount on the desks and stuff like that. It's a low-hanging fruit. Let's just go with it. And we set up a small office in the digital depot in 2012. And later on, we did have a couple of employees who were in sales and operations and stuff like that. And although it was not a fully established office, it was like a branch office of the Indian company back then. But slowly, it got more firmer and firmer and firmer. And in 2019, actually, we did set up the European headquarters with a proper subsidiary office. And now we are very well established and
bedded in Dublin
completely. And, you know, I moved to Ireland in 2018.
Okay.
And that was, that decision happened simultaneously of me coming here and setting up properly here as a subsidiary, as a European headquarters. And that's where also the international journey became much more stronger with international customers. So that's in short.
Sure. And I mentioned in the intro that, you know, you have about 100 plus languages. Is it still the focus of that kind of Indian, Asian subcontinent, or where does it, where do we spread now?
Yeah, no. So what happened was, like I said, initially we were talking to language service providers, and there the main requirement was to have an Indian or a Southeast Asian partner. But as we started acquiring, enterprise customers, as we call them, who had their own products and services, who were actually the real buyers of translation, it started getting more broader. So we went into the Middle Eastern languages as well, and then some of the African languages, South American languages, European languages. However, having said that, a lot of the growth story is still on the Asian side. And a lot of the companies who are looking at growth markets are looking always towards the eastern side. So while we do have a very robust, language spread, even with the European languages, but I think somewhere because of the DNA that we started with, if somebody were to give a extremely challenging and difficult project, which has to do with Southeast Asia, Asia, Middle East, and India, we would be, I think, 10% better as compared to some of the other areas. But having said that, I don't think there is a real difference now.
Right.
Till, I think, about 2017-18, we had this, like you mentioned, it was mostly East. But after we set up the headquarters here, we had a lot more customers who were asking for European languages first. Okay. And so we had to build that up over the last 5 years. And now I think 100 languages makes a very good spread.
And tell me this, how difficult is it to get access to those multi-language specialists?
It's nuanced in the sense that the way this business works is like this. Let me give you an example. So if you need legal advice, you would go to a lawyer. And if you need medical advice, you would go to a doctor. The language business is the same. If your customer is in the legal domain, you need to find somebody for that language specializing in the legal domain.
Okay.
You can't ask a doctor
to translate a medical to translate a legal document.
Exactly. Yeah. And vice versa.
Okay.
Add to that another complexity. A medical device company, let's say somebody who's making blood pressure or whatever, is selling somewhere. And so they need sales and marketing content on their website and their brochures. Now, these are two skills. You need to have the medical knowledge, but you need to also have the content specialization of being sales marketing as a kind of content. And then there is a third layer, which is your target audience. Think of it being explained to a kid in school as compared to an 80-year-old. Not everybody can play around with content with so many variations. So many times you have to look at somebody who's qualified medically. Can he actually do sales and marketing content for the website or for, let's say, a video, an ad advertising video, copywriting, stuff like that? And can he actually understand the target audience? Can he adapt his content towards a kid? Can he add humor? Can he be serious? So it really actually, so we do have a vendor management or vendor resource management department who day in, day out actually specialize in talking to resources to understand how they specialize. And
it's a bit like central casting in the movies, is it? That
it is. It is. So this the skill set is very important to be spot on. Otherwise, what happens is we don't know the language. Personally, I know three languages, but think about somebody as a client says, I need to do 40 languages.
Yeah.
I can't be doing 37, or even my employees can't do those 37. Yeah. So you have to rely on the talent who has the best judgment for that market.
Yeah.
So let's say somebody in Vietnam, you got to know he knows the Vietnamese market, their culture, all their sensitivities so that they don't use any bad names, bad language, etc., etc. On top of that, he has to be specializing in that particular domain, like legal, medical, whatever. He has to have the control over the type of content and then be able to address. It's all about the communication. Mm-hmm. Can he communicate with an 80-year-old as easily as to a 10-year-old?
Yeah.
And so some languages can be very challenging. And to start with, actually, Indian languages were the most challenging because back then, even Windows did not support some of the Indian languages. Mm. Till 2007, can you believe it? And we had to train the translators on specific software, fonts, desktop publishing applications, buy licenses for them and donate it to them. So India was one of those difficult markets where you were running against a very popular set of software and languages which did not support the Indian languages. But that also made us special.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody knew that trouble and nobody wanted to do that.
Deal with it. Yeah.
And that is what created a big reputation and brand for us, that if there is a difficult job,
give it to them.
Yeah. And that is what actually made our team very strong and confident, saying we can do anything on earth. But to say that we could solve all the challenges doesn't happen that way. Think about a lot of these African countries where they don't even have electricity, they don't even have computers. Forget about a digital content coming across. And that is still true for many parts of this world.
Okay.
For example, think about remote places. There's a place in China which has Hakka China as a language. The whole population is, I think, something like 10,000 or something, right? But there was a customer who wanted that. Try finding resources for that. And the customer is even willing to pay the premium.
Yeah.
And then you find somebody and he's wholly unreliable. He'll tell you he's going to give you the work in so many days and he vanishes.
Yeah.
What can you do? So the 100 languages that we are talking about are most sorted languages that we have.
Mainstream,
sorted.
If you will. Mostly mainstream.
80%. There is, of course, 20% languages. Like even in India, you've got 23 official languages. Out of that, 5 languages are very low resource languages.
Okay.
You won't find people on a computer being able to digitally produce content. And even some of the softwares that support those languages are very rare.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we do those because we always want to stay in that, special category.
The hard bit to do. Yeah.
Exactly. Because if we don't do it, then we are like any other company.
Talk to me about the growth by language framework for international expansion.
Yeah. So, starts with, I think maybe about 3 years back, And I want to connect it to maybe something which is talk of the times, AI.
Mm. I have 2 questions more coming up.
Okay, good. So a lot of people don't know that the language industry, incidentally, is probably one of the few industries which was already involving very similar technologies as AI a long time back.
Okay.
The name was different. We used to call it neural machine translation, NMT. You have heard machine translation. Within machine translation, there are different categories of machine translation. So there is statistical machine translation, there is neural machine translation, and rule-based translations. So the very first were rule-based translation, where you would almost think sentence by sentence. It's stored in somewhere and it just recalls. So it's not flexible enough. Then came the statistical model, which is very similar to AI in that sense, is it works on the statistical probability of it being correct.
Okay.
And then there is the neural machine, which is even one step ahead, which is kind of adaptive learning as you start using it and putting in the feedback and it keeps coming back with improved content. And I still remember we introduced this service in 2019 for many of our customers, and a lot of our customers hadn't heard about it, and I would say that we were probably a little early in talking about it. We didn't find a lot of takers or success from 2019, but during the COVID years, as there was a lot of pressure coming into the pricing and speed and people working from home, we saw a little bit of switch in the mindset that the customers had. And okay, so what's special about it? The first thing is high resource languages. Think about French, Spanish, those kind of languages, which have a lot of data that can be segregated by domain. Again, machine translations are also specialized domain by domain. So they are built domain by domain. And then you can even customize it per instance. So for example, Toyota as a company could have a customized machine translation engine for their own purposes.
Okay.
So the special thing was that if the quality of data you've put into it is good and there's a certain volume, then the output can be reasonably editable.
Okay.
So it's not going to give you 100%. It's probably going to give you, let's say, 60%, 70%. But the translator is going to say, okay, I can work on this as a base language and I will review, correct, and fix this content. So what it does ultimately is the capacity overall increases for translation, because 50 to 60% or 70%, the human doesn't need to do it from scratch. But having said that, he's still got to read that 70% to make sure he needs to fix it. And then he has to do the rest of the 30%, which is, let's say, call it crap. So the advantage is speed. And of course, because there's a certain portion which the machine has handled, the cost comes down. But the skill of the translator is slightly changed. He's no longer actually a pure translator now. He's moved on from being a translator to a reviewer post editor. And so even as a career progression, a lot of the translators understood that this is going to be something as a career option. And people started, not everybody, because some people feel threatened and stuff like that. Anyway, coming back to the original thing is, the machine translation as a, or a neural machine translation were already there as a system. So when AI came in as ChatGPT launch, a lot of the customers thought problem solved. And for 6 to 8 months time, we had almost like a lull, you know, customers paused, not giving us any project because they wanted to experiment with ChatGPT and see, can we actually eliminate this whole layer completely and do it all on our own self? And I'm pleased to tell you that after 7 to 8 months time, they realized that was not the case. So while it did give improvements, speed and stuff like that, there still was a lot of criticality in terms of the quality and finalization of the content before you publish it, especially brands. No brand is willing to put the bet of their trusted, you know, brand in a market without somebody signing it saying, this is ready to launch. So the observation is this, that the top high resource languages is something that you can still do with AI. And some of them are really good. They can give you even an 80-90% output. So you need very little post-editing, especially for e-commerce kind of content where you have product descriptions. But give it poetry and prose.
But is that then, you know, when you think about what you were saying earlier on about it's not just translation, it's having the knowledge about the industry, it's having the knowledge about the language, it's having the ability to sell, and it's having the ability to contextualize and be able to talk to the 10 and the 10-year-old or the 100-year-old, right? That the computer can kind of get you the first two levels, but you still need the human content because you've got to humanize the, get the content.
And that's where the growth by language thing comes, is while you can pick a completely human layer or a completely machine layer, The appeal to growth by language actually happened because we were noticing that customers are missing a point when they are thinking about the language and culture as an entry point, as a barrier point to go into different countries. So traditional translation companies They are focused on job work, as I call it. Give me a document, I will translate and give it back to you. What we are doing is we are saying, what is the translation going to be used for? What are you trying to communicate? So we are actually adding a value on top of the layer of language, which is we are saying, don't use language for translation. Use language for growth. Okay. So let's assume as an e-commerce store, let's say Shoes, Nike, or any other company. If they want to sell in 40 different companies and they have this, what they call as D2C, direct to consumer website. And while they have other channels, on the direct to consumer market, their website needs to talk to people directly.
In the language that they understand.
Not only the language, but think about certain kind of clothes or, okay, think about winter clothes. Mm. Can you actually sell even winter clothes in Thailand? You can't, because on an average, it's always above 25, 30 degrees. Yeah. So that's what we can call localization, because you are kind of adapting not the content, but even your product that needs to even be sellable in that market. So the language is or the language and culture is part of the market dynamics. So what we are talking here right now in Growth by Language is market, not language.
Okay.
And that's much more holistic. We found is when the AI thing came in, everybody was talking about the language problem is solved. And, you know, we had to go back to customers and say that we never were only talking about language. So we had to rebrand ourselves to give a more holistic picture saying, you know, actually what we are doing is not talking language only. We are making you relevant in the market.
Okay.
Which has culture, which has got usage preferences, behaviors, patterns. And you cannot be successful against your competitor if you are not showing the consumer that you are for them and you understand them very well. And that's what this Growth by Language happened a little bit in reaction to the AI thing. But like I said, we were already doing this from 2019. We were already using AI. We were already using human by loop kind of a thing. But I think what happened was good, because it kind of made us more focused in a more holistic way to be able to serve our clients. And now actually we partner with clients rather than stay one step away. Mm-hmm. So we tell our customers, if you're thinking about going to a new market, we are going to be doing a market study for you, whether even that is the right market for you. So two things happen. Let's say somebody has already tried a market. So three things as a result: successful, failed, or third, I don't know.
Mm.
And we find all these three. And that is where we start with our, you know, we call audit services. Okay, you are already in the market. Let's audit your results. Are you doing well? And the answer could be, I don't have the data to check that I'm doing well. Okay, can we set up stuff first to actually collect data? Let's say it's an e-commerce store. Do you have enough analytics to say customers are visiting your store, but they're abandoning your cart for whatever reason? There could be 50 different reasons. But you've got to have the data. And I've known many companies to have a free version of a tracking software on their website, which doesn't give you enough information. So we then advise them saying, okay, we need to actually have a tracker on your website to be able to tell us where the traffic is coming from. Why aren't they converting it? Are they spending enough time on the descriptions? Do you have actually the payment systems that work in that country? And you know, people can actually use their cards or whatever mechanism to pay for your products. Why are they abandoning their cart? Is there some kind of a trust building issue on them? So all of that is something that we try to audit for them and give them a picture if they're already there in the market and it's not working for them. But then there is the other side, which is, I have an aspiration. My product is really doing well in UK and Ireland. Can I try another market? I don't want to be taking too much of risk. Can I try Germany? Can I try Spain? So we would take their product, their information and everything else, And we may already have available data to be able to advise them, but sometimes we wouldn't, and we would take a primary research study and tell them what are the next three growth markets which they could go into without too much of an investment and risk. Go for a trial, a small trial. See and get the signals whether, you know, you're getting positive signals, and then, you know, plan for the big thing. And even when we plan for the big thing, we have a layer of a beta kind of a thing where we say, okay, just launch for 100 people and get their feedback to make it more perfect. So it's almost like a four-step process. Audit or study and check feasibility. Do a pilot. Full launch. But even at full launch, you do like a user UAT kind of a thing, user testing, checking for a small crowd. And then go for the big push in the marketing spends and promotions and campaigns, launch and stuff like that. That's the whole gamut of growth by language.
So in a way then, you know, the whole AI ChatGPT thing, was it a benefit to you to the extent that it allowed you to demonstrate the additional value add that you brought over and above translation?
I think for the first 6 to 8 months, it was scary.
Yeah.
Because we don't know what to do. We knew we were going after enterprise clients, but we didn't know the method to break through. We had a few enterprise clients, and like most of the enterprise clients we've acquired in the last 15 years continue to work with us. So we knew the trust base was there. We knew, we understood some of these customers. But when it came to the ChatGPT thing, we thought we have to change the story now, because the customers are coming back and questioning us as to why I should
go
give you this.
I
can give it to ChatGPT and I can probably hire a couple of guys and they will make sure this gets done. And in that way, it was a blessing in disguise, because we had to think hard. We actually employed a UK-based marketing specialist to advise us what's the best way. And I think that's the best thing we've done to rebrand and reposition ourselves. You need sometimes a kick on the backside to reset yourself. So yes, in hindsight, it galvanized us to go in that direction, for sure.
Now, we've been talking about, you know, your customers' brand and cultures and things like that, but what's the culture, do you think, in Brahman?
Good question. And I always say that culture is defined by not me, not the senior management, but the people. And I would start by saying that as a small company, we're still a small company. We're not, you know, a huge, big company. For a small company, especially, you know, with, you can say small companies have limited resources. We have employees, several employees in our company who are more than 10 years old. And even in the past, we've had employees who are like 14 years, 15 years. And we have an employee in our company who's more than 20 years been serving us. That, I think, defines, if anything, the togetherness as a culture that we have. So we try to solve problems as a team together. We trust each other. There is enough independent decision-making for people to try out experiments and fail. I always tell my people two things. I said, you do any decision on earth except one, money. What comes into the company and what goes out the company is my job. Don't go there. Anything else, do whatever you like. And when whatever you do, just keep me informed. You don't need my approval every time. Wherever there's a money issue, you need my approval. You set the agenda for everything else. So all the senior management, they give their departmental budgets. They get an approval once a year. And even on the financial budgets that they have for their departments, even there, they are independent to do whatever they like with that money. There are, of course, people who still feel they need to check, ask, whatever. But I think that the way we have built this company is there is enough independence decision making in the company, delegation of power, authority, whatever you may call it, is very natural, because that's the way we have been building. And it took me a long time personally to learn that, actually. So my first 10 years, I wasn't like that. But as you grow, you learn, you fall down, you pick yourself up. I learned this, that, you know, if we had to scale, we had to grow, you had to have more people who you can trust and trust them for their decisions. Mm-hmm. They will make mistakes. But don't I make mistakes? Mm-hmm. Even I do. So I think, you know, over a period of time, I've also been surrounded by a lot of senior people who can advise me on things. And that's made me kind of keep pushing in letting the control go. And many times I have met a lot of people in conferences and conversations. And I met a lady who told me a very interesting story about her job. I said, she had a funny designation. And I said, what does it mean? And she said, I've been hired by a company to make a team and replace myself within 6 months' time. And, you know, that clicked something inside me. I said, look, if tomorrow I have to really make this company independent, I have to think I don't exist. Yes. Mm-hmm. And while I kept trying this formula, you know, what actually helped me was coming outside of the actual office environment and move to Ireland. Because when I moved to Ireland, I couldn't see physically anybody. So it gave me a totally different perspective of building processes, system, putting in software that could enable virtual communication, distance communication, remote working and stuff like that. And that hugely helped during COVID, because by the time we had already kind of doing work from home, you know, people independently taking decisions from a distance, teams being in different places, I personally not being with the majority of the team in physical location. So I think over the last 25, 26 years, things have become more and more centered around employees in the company, the decisions they make. And I would say there is still a lot of work to do, but I think, you know, the teamwork friendliness within the within ourselves is a big culture there. And we don't have any boundaries. So our communication system has everybody in one place. So even a trainee could actually talk to me on that platform. They could simply send me a IM within our internal platform, and they could speak to me anytime. So everything is like very transparent from a communication point of view. There are no barriers in the company. But I think the people know when they need to come to me also, which is very important. And so that self-regulation, that self-discipline has come in spite of the fact that everything is like a, you know, glass, see-through kind of a thing. And that is an immense matter of pride, because as I see employees who are like 15 years old in the company, and there are employees who are like just 1 month old, everybody is on that platform, but everybody has that intelligence and that independent thinking and respect, who to approach when, for what purpose, blow the whistle when it requires to, and things like that. So that I think is defining, you know, culture in the company.
So, you know, with that, have you reached the point where you don't obsess about the small things now in the company?
Yeah, actually, it already happened sometime during COVID.
Right.
I was actually reading a book on don't fret the small stuff. Yeah. Don't sweat the small stuff. And it's all the small stuff.
Yeah.
And I still remember 3 months into that book, I read it three times, actually, to, you know, kind of imbibe those things inside me. And the first thing I noticed was my wife telling me, she said, why are you trying tricks on me? Mm-hmm. I said, no, I'm not trying any tricks on you. No, you've got this new way of dealing with things. You're not fighting with me anymore. I said, no, I'm just the way it is. But, you know, later on, I realized it was probably the book having an effect on me.
Yeah.
But I think it made a huge difference to the way I further delegated from then on, the trust levels and everything else, because I understood that it's probably not worth going into the micro things most of the time, because that also affects my own health. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I call it, you can't be hyper-vigilant mm-hmm. all the time. And so I think it made me a better person as well, I think.
The other thing too, I suppose, when you look at the growth of the company, right, there's always, as a company becomes more successful or gets bigger, two things can happen. One, there's a risk that they get distracted and go into areas they shouldn't do. Or two, there's a risk they sit on their laurels and don't innovate enough. And then there's the bit of, well, if you're innovating, how much is too much innovation, which becomes a distraction. So,
yeah.
So talk to me through how you view that spectrum as you've gotten bigger.
I would be lying to you if I told you we haven't made all of those mistakes. Throughout these 25 years, we've tried different experiments. And I think that it's good to experiment to see how much you can stretch yourself. Mm-hmm. It's like a rubber band. You don't know how much it can mm-hmm. go. But stretching it a little bit too far can also break it. So I think we have been stretching and experimenting with several ideas. So we, during COVID times, a lot of the feedback we got from our customers is about remote simultaneous interpretation. It's called RSI. So one of the associated services in this area is interpretation. Mm-hmm. We don't do any of that. Mm-hmm. But back during COVID, what happened was, because there was a lot of online meetings and stuff like that, the remote interpretation business was in very high demand. And we caught those signals from some of our customers. Quickly, we made an online platform. We partnered with platform companies that would provide remote simultaneous interpretation. We got the services together. We hired a small team. So there was significant investment in building the software, the platform, integrating the platform, building the whole interpretation network. I think the product and the idea was fantastic. But I think... one, we were slightly delayed in the execution and we focused too much on perfecting the platform. And I think we were late in executing the sales side of things. And what ultimately happened was COVID doesn't last forever. So by the time we started selling and going into the market, and the COVID thing was like on and off, right? You know, there was areas where, you know, people would go to office and come back. And at the end of 2 years, we were sitting with a product and everything else ready to go. We made a couple of sales, that's it. But it wasn't really the kind of success we had hoped for. And we were heavily assuming that, you know, the COVID effect would last in the interpretation business. Of course, it didn't. So there were experiments throughout these years that we have done with related areas, not completely unrelated mm-hmm. areas, to see whether some of them have been a success. For example, like I said, the machine translation, post-editing, related services that we introduced in 2009, hugely successful. Because we wouldn't have been in this situation had we not introduced in 2009. It took a time to explain to customers what are the benefits. So I think that, there have been failed experiments and there have been successful mm-hmm. experiments. And I would say that we would continue to do those kind of experiments, but we are also very conscious, because when it comes to the decision making, I think at the level of our board, we have really grounded people and they kind of keep your train on the track. Mm-hmm. So while we have experimented... with some of these ideas, and we've failed with these ideas, but we always start up with a appetite question, saying, what's the appetite mm. we have got that if we put in 100,000 and we lose, are we okay with it? Mm. So we keep all those ifs and buts in mind, and it's almost like a controlled risk we are trying to take.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I think more experiments have been successful than not. Even the growth by language, when we started, you know, working on it, was an experiment,
yeah.
but it's paying off.
Yeah.
So I think as entrepreneurs, we have to learn to take risks. We have to take risks. Because if you don't do anything, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
But I think it's also very important for people who are super aggressive and they may bet everything. They may get a very high success rate, but there's also a chance of sinking.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those characters who can take very high risks. That's the character I am. I try to balance things out. I'm more of a calculated risk taker than an outright aggressive entrepreneur. So that, I think, is one of the traits which has kept us alive for 25 years. Because if we had been extremely aggressive, I think some of these experiments could have gone in a direction where we would have over-invested or over-relied on and not cut the losses where we had to cut the losses. So I think we continue to be on that journey. Of course, we don't have control over market forces. And I think as a company in these 25 years, we've been extremely flexible to see the market signs. We were a learning technology, e-learning, online learning company. But as we saw signals into languages, we got into languages.
Yeah.
As we saw signals into machine translation related services, we got into that. And now with the AI thing, we've got those signals and we've remodified our whole standing. So I think these 25 years may be like four different startups in that sense.
Okay.
It's not one single company. Yeah. We are reinventing every 5-6 years is how I see it.
Okay. So on that basis then, are you a fast or slow decision maker?
I think it's for people to say whether I am, but I think when it comes to money, I'm a slow decision maker.
Okay.
For many of the operational items, I'm extremely fast. In fact, I can't sleep at night if I haven't taken that decision.
Okay. Yeah. And then how do you make decisions? Are they data-based or are they gut feel?
Both.
Okay.
When it is operational, analytical data.
Mm.
But some of it cannot, you don't have the data. I mean, growth by language was one of those things where it was just gut. We have to go, we have to innovate ourselves and just go with it.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier on when you started the business, you were 24 and, you know, you didn't have a lot to lose. You didn't anything to say. But as you progressed through the years, has fear of failure ever been a driving force for you?
I would be lying if I said there wasn't fear of failure. But,
okay.
You know, it's... the fear of failure earlier on was much higher.
Right.
As we proved ourselves in multiple forums, I think the feeling now is we've achieved something already. And nothing is permanent forever. So now we don't have to prove anything to anybody. We've created history. We've won awards. The brand is visible and recognized by people. And I think when we started out, we didn't have those as objectives. But once we realized ourselves that we've fulfilled some of these objectives, I think that fear has now gone. It's more of a quiet satisfaction saying, okay, we've got somewhere. We could have completely sunk ourselves, but we got somewhere. Now I don't think there is so much of the fear of failure. Now it's like we already have a base.
Yeah.
It's only ahead.
Incremental then on top.
Yeah.
What's the hardest job being the boss?
What's the hardest job? Okay, that's... I never thought about that.
That's why you're here.
Hardest job. I think change management.
Okay.
I think especially if there are certain market conditions. I remember COVID was extremely challenging period for me because customers didn't know much what's going to happen. We didn't know what's going to happen. And we had almost a 40% reduction in our revenues. I didn't want to sack the kids because it's none of their fault. But you didn't know till when. I think those uncertainties, those situations are the most difficult situations for me because what decision do you take? Because you don't even have alternatives. And, you know, you talk to as many people as you like. Everybody is in the same boat. But I think somewhere inside me, we had internal discussion and I was almost on the verge of breakdown to say, okay, that's it. We've got to cut certain things to be able to survive. And just then we saw the ray of hope of life. And I'm glad to say that during those periods, we didn't have to let anybody go. So there are, I don't think a lot of situations like that have happened. There have been some situations, but COVID was especially very challenging as a period, and decision-making back then from financial point of view, from resources point of view, from the direction point of view, it was a huge thing.
You talked about staff and you've mentioned them a few times, but what's your approach? Is it hire talent or develop from within? What's your preference?
Our earlier principle had been develop.
Okay.
And we've had huge success bringing in interns, almost like molding them like clay through a process. And a lot of the people who have survived with us for 14, 15 years, even 20 years, have been in their first or second jobs or right. even interns. So we've got great success there. But I think over a period of time, we realized that it has to be mix and match. Is that sometimes you need the speed and you have to hire particularly certain kind of talent which none of us already got. I don't understand it, for example, very well. And there are people who don't understand it. And to learn and do it, you're going to lose out the market by the time. So after I think about 2015-16, we've taken this as a mix and match is we should have enough. And also what I realized is some of the best of our people have been not even from the language industry.
Okay.
So we did this almost like a parallel hiring. So looking at the talent, which could almost like complement or supplement our existing set of things. And so then, you know, there are other industry benchmarks which we have adopted, and that seems to have worked very well. I still remember initially when we had a very large client, I said, you don't have translators on your roles. Everybody is a manager in your company. I said, what's wrong with that? No. How will you control your languages if you don't have translators in-house? I said, anytime we can't have 100 translators and multiplied by the domain, you're talking about 500 translators if I were to hire people. I can't do it anytime. Okay, I could probably do for a couple of languages where we have very high volume. And we did have a team internally about 22 translators at one point of time. But you know, the thing about this business is today you have some language which is very high and tomorrow you don't. What do you do with those people? So we got to a formula where we said, okay, we will retain those people who are either flexible enough to be available in different roles. They have a good quality of mind to adapt to situations, to the market, to skills and everything else. But we will also have fresh set of kids who can be molded with them. I think right now we have the great team of all the times. In the last 5 years, I think we've built this combination of outside talent with fresh energy and blood. So you need the experience and you need the energy.
Yeah.
And I think we are doing both right now. And also the remote working has given us that flexibility, because now we can hunt for talent anywhere. So we are just adapting to what we need right now.
What advice would you give to young people today?
I keep telling that to my son, and if he hears this podcast tomorrow, he's going to say, same old guy saying same old things.
Doesn't matter, everybody else won't have heard it, so you can tell everybody else.
I think that there are certain things which never will go out of fashion, and I think the core principle to think about for younger people is whether it is success or failure, you have to keep trying. What I see in a lot of the younger kids is they give up too easy. And I can tell you within these 25 years, there have been several occasions where I could say, "I that's it.
Pull the ripcord.
That's
done.
It. Yeah. But every time I have spoken to my mentors or my coaches and my senior people, and I come back to the drawing table again to look at the picture and see what I can do about it, let me give it another shot. If it doesn't work, okay. But I'm not going to put in my towel right now. And many a times it's that last effort which worked. That, I think, is, you call it determination, you call it commitment to the cause.
Resilience, call it whatever you like.
Resolution, whatever you like, but don't throw in the towel just yet. Because there is another second side of the story is, if you're going to be trying something new and second, what's the guarantee even that's going to succeed? At least you understood something. Yeah. You put in your time, effort, and money. Can you just give it another reasonable quality of effort with all your heart, mind, and soul inside it? Okay, you can scientifically decide what's your limit. Maybe you don't have the money or whatever, and that's it. After that, you can't, because you just can't. But if it's not costing you money, it's your time, your effort, your energy, then don't stop.
Give it one more go.
Give it one more go. If that doesn't happen, give it another one. And I think that, you know, I can't tell you the number of examples we've had in those situations where we've, in the second, third, fourth, fifth. There's a very nice story about the Angry Birds company. I don't know if you know about it. And this is one of the things I had heard very early, and I got to know about these two brothers who finally made Angry Birds what it is today. They were kids at the age of, I think, 13, 14 or something like that. And their mom always used to say, forget about making games and, you know, get to your studies kind of a stuff. Angry Bird, when it became what it is as the first game which hit the markets and became really popular and viral, was, I think, their 49th or the 47th game. And before that, the 46th time.
Hadn't worked.
Nothing worked. Yeah. It's such a great story. I had, you know, there was a conference in India where these two brothers had come and I'd met them there, and they spoke about this story. It's an amazing, amazing resilience story as to keep trying, keep trying, keep trying, keep trying. That's my only single advice. Don't throw in the towel just yet. Okay, keep on it.
That's a good one. And I have one related one then. What is, have you an exit strategy? Because at one stage, the towel may not be thrown in, but it might have to be folded and put on a chair.
Yeah. No, I look, from time to time, we've had this discussion internally about what is that. And I think somewhere down the line, there will be one. Not just yet.
Yeah.
But I think that we have something in mind where we want to achieve as a number in terms of sales, and then think about an exit. Not just yet.
Yeah. Okay. Right. The black book time
comes along.
The black
book, yes.
Here we go. Can't guarantee what it's going to be. And it gets harder sometimes to read the people's handwriting, but right. Okay. We kind of touch a bit on this, but it's still good. How do you make sure the management team buy into the agreed culture and style of the business?
So when it means management, does it mean the founders, the...
Your senior management.
Actually, like I said, I think that the first thing that I said when you asked that question was, it's not me and the senior management in the first place which defines the culture.
Yeah.
It's, I think, as a signal or a messaging that starts from top as to what you want to become as a company internally. What are your aspirations for the different stakeholders? So whether it is customers, whether it is your supplier partners, how do you want to create that culture of mutual respect, and everybody is important in the as stakeholders from different, if you look at the 360 side of things. I think from a messaging point of view, you have to set out a few principles, let's call it that way. And then give enough opportunities to people to understand these principles and then really implement them. I don't think it's really an HR job or it's any one person's job. I think the constant messaging and your own actions I mean, I can preach the whole earth to them, but if I don't practice it,
they'll see it through very quickly.
Very quickly. So I think that in our company, actually setting examples has worked very well. When they see somebody actually doing it in practice, even their email going in a certain way, we actually do something called the communication meetings, in which it's like a town hall. Mm. Everybody comes in, they're open to say anything, suggestions, disagreements, whatever. So I think it has to be that constant messaging as to what you stand for, what you are building as a culture. And everybody is kind of putting in their effort and part in making sure that that actually spreads from topmost. And we as senior people, we have to practice that. If we don't practice it, you can say whatever you like.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I would just like to thank my guest, Biraj Rai. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we will see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy, and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.